Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitar gigs that I recently got to test drive. The S1 has two separate channels. It's got one for guitar and one for microphone, and there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you can access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch input. And the S1 is actually portable and rechargeable for up to 11 hours. So the guitar and mic channels, they have separate independent tone, volume, and reverb controls, and they also have something called a proprietary tone match switch, which EQs, optimizes, and restores the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically your biggest problem when you're playing acoustic amps. I tested the S1 speaker, and it's very responsive to pickups, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls genuinely work great. You can position the S1 four different ways. You can tilt it back to broadcast out to an audience, or you can put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. The S1 also has a proprietary Bose accelerometer, which automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound based on whichever one of these four positions you're using. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. So the bottom line is, if you're an acoustic player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big, that's portable and battery powered. And the S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker Bose makes, which says a lot. I used it myself for a party we had here one night, and it was absolutely amazing. All my kids were freaking out. It's like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can easily use this for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend thousands of dollars on a bunch of equipment to get the same thing the S1 does. On top of that, it's sleek and it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years from any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, I'd like you to go to pro.bose.com/podcast. Check it out at pro.bose.com/podcast and get the S1. It's outstanding. This is an important announcement for anyone thinking about advertising here on Everyone Loves Guitar. We've experienced incredible growth. We currently have over 82,000 monthly listens, and I would anticipate cracking six figures in the next few months. We've also grown our YouTube subscriber base by 72 times. During this time, we've kept our advertising rates consistent, but I wanted to let you know we'll be increasing these rates after the first of the new year. So if you're a business looking to generate new leads or increase your cash flow by adding new clients or customers, or if you're looking for general brand exposure, or if you're a label looking to promote new music and you want to lock into the current advertising rates before they go up at the end of this year, then listen closely. Fill in the short form at everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Even if you want to advertise next year, contact us now and you'll get to lock into the current rates before they go up at the end of this year. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
If you want to buy or sell a home or investment property and you're here in the Tampa Bay area in Hillsborough, Pinellas, or Pasco counties, then listen up. West Florida Real Estate is a local residential real estate broker that's helped over 250 Bay Area homeowners buy and sell their properties in the last 4 years alone. If you're looking to sell, you'll want to get their free report, The 7 Biggest Mistakes Homeowners Make When Hiring a Realtor. And if you're looking to buy a property, you definitely want to get your hands on The 21 Most Expensive Mistakes Tampa Home Buyers Make When Buying a Home. Each one of these reports is going to save you time and money. Inside, you'll discover the 7 most important things to consider when hiring a realtor, what to do if you're buying and selling a home at the same time, and the danger of choosing a realtor who agrees with everything you say. To get your hands on these free reports, head on over to westfloridarealestate.com. That's westfloridarealestate.com.
Hey, this is Craig. If you like this show and you want to support it and you want to keep it free, head on over to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/support.
Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We're going to give some love to the rhythm section today. I've got a really cool guest. I've been really excited, looking forward to talking with Kelly Lemieux. And before we get started, I just want to say shout out to Kevin Cipriano for hooking us up, our mutual buddy.
Hey, Kevin.
Yeah, there you go, man. So Kelly started his professional career as a founding member of the popular LA band, the Electric Love Hogs. They were quickly discovered by Motley Crue's Tommy Lee. Lee produced their first album for London Polygram Records. He later joined the indie power pop band 22 Jacks, featuring members of the Foo Fighters, Adolescents, and Wax. One of the highlights of Kelly's tenure with 22 Jacks was recording and playing live with Joey Ramone, who was a fan of the band. Kelly then joined the highly influential punk ska band Goldfinger in 98, and he continues touring and recording with them. Megadeth's Dave Mustaine, who's no stranger to great musicians, called on Kelly's services for his side project, MD45, which featured Dave on guitar, Lee Ving on vocals. That is such a cool name. What's your name? Lee Ving. That's like...
That's his real name, Lee Capilaro, but Lee Ving is way cooler.
Oh my God. It's like he'd never fuck with that guy.
Started your name, so, you know.
And Jimmy DeGrasso on drums. Kelly's talents were tapped again when Lee Ving, singer of the seminal punk band Fear and MD45, needed a bassist. Kelly immediately filled the spot and went on several successful tours with that band. In 98, Paul Gilbert himself brought Kelly on to tour internationally with his first post Mr. Big solo project. That turned out to be just the start of something bigger as Paul brought Kelly on again in 2012 to record his new solo album Vibrato and the supporting tour of the record in Japan. In Japan, Europe, and beyond. Paul also brought Kelly on as a rhythm section for his Great Guitar Escape summer camp in 2012 and 13. Kelly's been the bass player for Buckcherry since 2013. And that same year, he also joined Stork, which is a progressive metal band led by Thomas Lang. Let me tell you, I've really been looking forward to talking to Kelly because he told me his story and he'll talk about it. This guy is a fucking warrior. I'm always, as you know, attracted to people that have been through the shitter and come out still smiling because it, you know, life is tough, man. It takes a lot not to be a dick when you got beat up, right? Kelly's beaten both.
I was just trying not to be a dick earlier today. It's kind of hard.
He's beaten both cancer and drug addiction. He's an incredibly humble and grateful guy, and we'll talk about this today. Dude, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me, Craig.
That's my pleasure, honestly. So whatever happened to Electric Love Hogs? You guys broke up after the first album. Great band, really great grooves there, man.
What happened? Well, you know, power struggles, I think. We had a key member, Dave Kushner, who, if anybody knows, is the other guitar player from Velvet Revolver that isn't Slash. Dave went up to that. Everybody's like, "Is I love Dave. Dave is an awesome dude. Great musician, great dude. He was the one that everybody was like, is the Edge playing in Velvet Revolver now? Because he always wore the beanie and had the... But I love Dave. Dave's awesome. Dave split and the dynamics changed. And they wanted to go a completely, you know, that was during the time of the Panteras. And everybody wanted to be super metal. And we were not a super metal. We were kind of a thrash, punk, funk sort of band. And it was. I love those guys, but it was kind of one of those things where the inmates took over the prison and I dug a hole and got out.
Well, good for you.
And then John went on, who was the singer, John went on to do Goldfinger, who I later played with. Love John. Bobby, the drummer, went on to play with the band Orgy. And Donnie, who is a phenomenal guitar player, he just kind of moved back up to the Bay Area and chilled out. I think he's playing again. I think he just started playing another band recently. So, it petered out. I think once Dave and I split, the label was like, too many member changes. And, band's shelf life generally, it's like an NFL running back. You know, what is it? 2 to 4 years.
I was just thinking that when you said that. Yeah, that's funny.
It really is. It's like, we blew our knee out. We're done.
Yeah. That's right. 2 to 4 years. It's very, very correct. So 22 Jacks, you guys were around for 6 years. Anything in particular happened there or that was just it ran its course? Same stuff.
No, they kept going. I actually got the I got the Goldfinger gig in the middle of a tour. And that 22 Jacks was a great band, great musicianship, just good songwriting, really cool. Like you said, Joey Ramone loved us. I mean, if it wasn't for that band, I never would have gotten to do anything. We recorded a song. We actually did a Cheap Trick song. We did I'll Be With You Tonight. And Ed Stasium produced it, who did all those great Ramones records. We did it at A&M, and that's when Chris from the Foo Fighters, was before he got the Foo Fighter gig, mm-hmm. he was doing No Use for a Name. Chris was playing guitar on that.
Chris Shiflett.
And I had, Chris Shiflett. Love Shifty. And, all those guys were just really good. It was one of those things where it's like, okay, next tour, we're going to make money. It was always one of those next tour. And I was just like, man, I think I did the math in 2 years. We put 50,000 miles on our van, and I just was like, man, I gotta make money. I can't do this anymore. I'm tired of the payoff. And John, who I played with in Love Hugs, hit me up and was like, hey man, because I filled in for their old bass player. So the one thing I don't like about using my phone is every text message and every Facebook message comes in. John hit me up. I filled in for Simon, their old bass player. And he's like, hey man, he's like, you want to come do this full time? He's like, it's not working out with Simon. I think Simon really liked touring that much, and they toured like crazy. And so I finished the tour up and said, hey guys, I got another gig and it's paying. And the first thing we did with Goldfinger was, we did Spiral Staircase cover I Love You More Today Than Yesterday for the Waterboy soundtrack.
That's cool.
So that was my first thing, and shot a video for it. It was cool. I love the 22 Jacks, but it was taking too long, and I was tired of being poor.
Man, I totally get it.
It's a difference between touring in a van and touring in a bus. It's night and day.
Yeah.
I paid my dues. Can I swear on this?
Oh, you could fucking say whatever you want.
Okay. I paid my dues. I'm fucking done.
Yeah, man. I hear that.
Anyways,
so what was your experience like touring and recording with Paul? That must have been really cool.
I love Paul. He's as much of everybody thinks of him as this consummate shredder. He's a huge, huge, just fan of music like I am. Music nerd. I mean, in all types. For a while we would have you seen Karen Carpenter doing this drum solo? Oh, dude, check this. We would send each other. Have you heard this Ronnie James Dio doing the frog on this cartoon singing all this just crazy, inane. Paul loves B.B. King. He loves Paganini. He listens to everything. And working with that guy really, I got to, A, you got to bring your A game. And B, he always makes me a better player. He's always got insight. He's a great teacher. I can't blow enough sunshine up his big, tall ass.
That's great, man. That's really
he's
cool.
Just a great dude. He actually lives in Portland now. He's 2 miles from me.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And he asked me to do his new record in this tour, but I'm doing Buck Cherry, and I would love to have done it. I did some of the demos for it, some of the tryout stuff, and always love Paul. Paul, if you hear this, always call me. If I'm ever available, I will always do it.
Very cool, man.
And he's a great, great teacher. I learn a lot playing with that guy. He's got a ton of fucking insight.
That's awesome, man.
So, I love that guy. He's awesome.
Where'd you grow up originally? You live in Portland now, but where'd you grow up?
Let's see.
Motorhead. With your Motorhead cup. Yeah, I'm just digging that.
Yeah, I love Motorhead. So I was born in Oregon. My mom and dad met in Salem, Oregon, where my mom was from. And when I was born in Salem. And then they moved. I was a couple years old. They moved to Minnesota. Hence my Viking allegiance. School. And I know it's sad, but at least I'm not a Buffalo Bills fan. Sorry. What time Super Bowl losers. At least we spread it out over like a decade or two.
Yeah.
but anyways, we'll get into sports later. And then we moved to Minnesota, and we lived there all through the 70s. And then my mom, my dad was a car transport driver at that time in the 70s. And he slipped off like one of the top rungs securing a car.
Holy crap.
And landed on his back and was out of work for a couple, 2-3 weeks. And my dad's a tough Minnesota farm kid. That dude's. You think I'm tough? That motherfucker's tough as nails.
That's cool.
And you know, we're just a bunch of squatty, hairy little Frenchmen, French Canadians. And my mom was like, you know what? Fuck this weather. I'm sick of this 20 below shit winters. So we moved back to Salem, Oregon. So I actually did from 12 until I was probably 19 or 20. I lived in Salem, Oregon, and then moved to Los Angeles.
Okay. What prompted you to move to – you moved to L.A. for your career?
Absolutely. And I had, you know.
Was there something specific you moved for? Like, was there a specific gig waiting for you, or you just knew that you had to get there to get track for it?
Well, it was funny because I moved to LA in early 88. And it was one of those things where I was like, well, I can move to Seattle. And this was before the grunge scene blew up. I can move to Seattle where the weather's shittier.
Right.
And the people are even more fucking depressed. Or I can move to LA where all my favorite bands came from, baby.
Yeah.
And you know, sun, hot chicks, you know, LA back then was the fucking place.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of friends that went to, I had a buddy that went to MI, my buddy, Jeff Fuller, who was like, hey dude, fucking come back here. It's like, I got you a job. My other friend, Laura Bennett, who actually she moved back to Salem. And she's like, you can stay at my place until you get on your feet, da 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 da. And, you know, I asked my dad, and, you know, I just saw the local scene, and I'm like, oh, man, this is a fucking dead end. There's no way I'm going to go anywhere. Yeah. Nobody was coming out of – there was Dan Reed Network, New Shoes, and Quarter Flash, but I'm
– Quarter Flash. Wow, I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, they're hard to hear. And
I didn't know they were from Salem.
No, they're from Portland. I'm counting Portland bands. The only people that have really come out of Salem was my buddy Dean Castronovo, who I grew up with.
Oh, that's wild.
Dude, he's awesome. And I mean, just like watching him as a kid, I was just like, fuck, and being a bass player. I got to play with him when I was younger too.
That's really cool.
And he was always kind of an inspiration to get the fuck out. He's like one of the few dudes that like, you know, kind of got out. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else from Salem other than Napoleon Dynamite, but he was after me. And I think he was a transplant also. Gosh, who else? Somebody's going to be like, you forgot about this guy.
No, don't worry about it. You can't make everybody happy. Trust me.
Yeah. So anyways, you know, I just was like, there's nothing going on in Salem. I didn't want to move to Portland. Black and Blue came out of Portland. There was not a lot of bands. LA seemed like the place to be. Guns N' Roses just started blowing up. And everybody was like, come to LA. I had another buddy, Les Riggs, who was a drummer. And he was like, come down here, man. We'll fucking hook you up. So I was like, fuck it. I moved down. I had a shitty, I wish I still had that car. I had a $500 Datsun
B210? I had one of those.
B210.
I had that, man. It was mine was 700.
Yeah, and I had that sucker. It was like this horrible, like, fucking pea green or whatever. I didn't give a shit. It got me down there. Yeah. It lasted about 8 months, and then it took a crap. But I lived four blocks from my work. I worked at NRG, National Research Group.
That's so funny. Like,
every musician worked at. For at least a little while. I was lucky though. I worked in the coding department. I didn't have to make phone calls.
Wow. So, that's funny.
Yeah. And then I looked at the local scene and I'm like, I saw the best bands there and I was like, man, this just is not good enough for me.
What, once you got down there, what was there a turning point where you started like getting steady work or how did you get your first gigs and stuff like that?
It was a fluke. It was a total fluke. Well, actually, you know what's funny is I did have an audition. Now that you think about it, my buddy Jeff got me an audition with this band who was called the World's Cutest Killers. And they needed a bass player. And it was Kelly Johnson from Girl School and Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's.
That's funny, man. The World's Cutest Killers.
Yeah. And I got the audition. I went down. I crushed it. I didn't get the gig, which I was fine with. But in the meantime, there was a thing before the internet called the Recycler and the Music Connection. And there would be ads on there. And I went down for everybody looking for a bass player. And, you know, when I moved to L.A., I was so like, oh, my God, I'm going to be the shittiest bass player there. There's going to be all these amazing musicians. And it's just I'm going to have to go in there. And, you know, at that point, which we can get into later, I was really I'd kind of left metal in the dust and was really getting into more funk stuff. This would have been like 86, 87 funk, or what would have been pre-funk metal. That first Faith No More record.
Oh, that was a great record, man.
With Chuck Mosley, the original singer.
That was great.
Introduce Yourself. That one. I heard that. And I heard the Chili Peppers on that show Night Flight. And I heard Fishbone. And I was like, what in Sam Hain is this? And at the same time, I was listening to Terrence Trent D'Arby, Stanley Clark. I was really into, like, I was playing, before I moved to LA, I was playing fretless and slapping. I was doing slap on a fretless. What? This is in like 86, 87.
You just got into it, or that's pretty cool.
I was really like, I was like, I don't want to be Jaco Pastorius, but I love fretless bass. To me, it was like, it almost had like a horn trombone. You can slide notes. I love the phrasing of it. Unfortunately, nobody wants to hear that shit in rock music. I mean,
no.
What's Tony Franklin doing? I mean, I know he's amazing, awesome bass player, but it's like, you know, he got the Firm gig and Blue Murder, but it's like, there's not a lot of call. Like, you show up to a rock gig with a fretless bass and dudes just look at you and go, the fuck, Jocko, get out of here. So I moved to LA. I was playing, I moved there with I think I had a fretless jazz bass or some shit with Bartolini's in it. Bartolini's. And I was slapping and popping and, you know, just, and I got there and everybody was, all these bass players were slinging a T-bird down to their fucking knees with a pick, playing root notes. And I just went, ah, fuck. And, you know, dropped my bass down to my knees. And so I went to did the Music Connection thing and started hitting these dudes up. And I remember I just turned 21 and I walked down to the liquor store on Hollywood and Argyle, right by where I work, kind of down by the Chinese Theater. And I walked down there to buy myself a moose head beer or whatever the fuck. And I came back and my friend Laura that I was staying with at the time, a couple blocks away. And she's like, hey, somebody called from Music Connection. And I'm like, and I had them all like starred and circled. And I'm like, was it this one? I don't know. This one? This one? I think so. And so I called them back and I'm all, hey, did you call me about Music Connection? And they're like, no. I'm all, do you need a bass player? And they're all, yeah. And I'm like, okay. Woke me up. And I'm like, okay. And I went to their place and it was John Feldman who I ended up playing with years later who I played with in the Love Hogs. We ended up, he had another band called Faith that was very U2 meets The Cult meets Gene Loves Jezebel.
Wow.
Which I was into all bands also. And I did a couple of shows with them. And I'm like, man, this sucks. I don't want to do this shit. And kind of kept looking for other gigs. And he called me a couple weeks later after those gigs. We opened like San Diego. We played with Lions and Ghosts and all these. And only old school LA dudes are going to know these bands. But and he called me up. He's all, hey, man, I'm putting like a Chili Pepper Fishbone band together. I want you to fucking play slap bass in it, bro. Bring your fretless. And I was like, hells yeah, motherfucker. He's like, I got a gig booked in 2 weeks. We got to write songs. We got to learn some covers. We're going to go, because they already had a following.
That was so exciting.
Band. So we did that. We did a show. We played with this band, the Tremors from San Diego, that they used to play with. And we wrote probably half that Love Hog record in like fucking 2 weeks. And then we went and did the show. It was off the fucking chain. They booked us again a month later. We wrote more songs, blah, blah, blah. Had a killer following in San Diego. Couldn't get arrested in L.A. And then there was a cancellation at the Whiskey No Bozo Jams. And anybody who's from L.A. back in those days knows those were the No Bozo Jam. English Acid had another one of those nights. There was these nights where they were all backlined. You would show up, play a 15-minute set, and then, you know, go drink as many $2, $1 beers and eat free hot dogs or whatever the fuck. And somebody canceled prime time. I forget who it was. I happened to be there. I didn't even know about it. I was already like three beers in. And my guitar player, one of the guitar players, showed up with my gig bag. And I'm like looking at him, I'm like, what the fuck? Cutting his way through the crowd. And he goes, we're on in a half an hour. Get ready. And I'm like, what the fuck? Went up, we played to this crowd. Nobody knew who the fuck we were. We crushed it. And after that, it was on like Donkey Kong.
That's so cool. Yeah, that's really not. So it was serendipity.
It happened pretty quick. I'd say within, you know, about a year of being there, we were kind of somewhat known. And then, you know, we were on the cover of LA Rock Review or what are all the, oh, I'm forgetting all the fucking math. There's so many of those,
local magazines in LA.
Yeah, ended up on the cover of them, and then, you know, next thing you know, Tommy Lee's producing with Mark Dodson. We did a Love Hogs record, and that came out, and you know, like we got into that why that fizzled out, but we did that record with Tommy, which was great. I got to hang out with Tommy for like 6 months. It was after they did the Dr. Feelgood record. Actually, my first time at the NAMM show. I went with Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx.
That must have been pretty cool for a young kid.
It was a fucking trip.
Yeah.
And those guys were so gracious to their fans. That's one thing I learned from them was how gracious they were. The only time they were even remotely persnickety was when we went to eat at like Hamburger Hamlet or someplace in Anaheim after the NAMM show. And both of them were sitting there and they were both like full on hamburgers, just and these two fans came up very sheepishly and can we get your autographs? And they're both like just mid like went like this, finished chewing, which you wouldn't think Motley Crue would do. and then turned around and both went, you know what? Can you wait till we're done eating and come back? We'll totally sign anything you want.
That was actually really cool.
Very cool. On the other hand, we were walking around and we think we were outside of the convention center. And I heard these, you know, there's always like, if you're on top doing anything, there's always these fucking little fucking yappy shit dogs that fucking love to talk shit. Trash talk because they're jealous. They got fucking nothing in their world. Yeah. And I heard this dude go, fucking Motley Crue, you didn't even play on your fucking own records. And I just go, did you hear what those little fucking shitbirds just said? And both of them turned around, Tommy and Nikki both, without flinching and went, and there was like a group of two or three of them. And they went, what the fuck did you say, motherfuckers? Dude, they were like totally starting to bum rush. And I'm like, chill out, bro. These guys, it's not. And they were like ready to fucking throw down at the drop of a hat. That's why, like, you know, when I read the dirt, because they actually mentioned the Love Hogs, I was like, yeah. I was just like, yeah, these dudes are nuts. And they were sober at that time when I was hanging. They were all totally clean. And I've seen Tommy since then drink. And I love Tommy, but he's kind of a different person when he drinks.
Yeah. So, well, I think most addicts are, man. You know, that's, you know, that's unfortunate.
There's like a complete kind of switch disconnect when he gets alcohol in him. And, you know, I love the guy. He's a fucking phenomenal drummer. I mean, I got to jam with him when we were doing pre-production. And I was like, holy shit, dude, I'm all should be playing in a funk band, dude. Like, he's a funky motherfucker.
That's cool.
Anyways,
you just let's segue. You just mentioned getting sober. You've been sober for a while now, and just to the extent you're comfortable chatting about it, I have a few questions.
I haven't drank 14 years. I'm going to put a disclaimer on it because when I was going through my chemo, it was so gnarly. I started smoking pot for it, and in a lot of circles. You know, so depending on where you go,
I know exactly where you're going with this.
There's a hey man, you took like a Tylenol PM more than three times. You're not sober, bro.
Well, you know,
I don't drink anymore, but I did smoke weed when I was going through my chemo, and I will occasionally still smoke or do an edible. So, I want to put a disclaimer to any of you. AA Nazis out there.
I was going to say the AA Nazis, man. Yeah.
Well, they call it marijuana maintenance. Yeah. And a lot of, I know people in Hawaii, they're like, I'm 20 years sober. And then they go home and smoke an ounce of weed. So whatever the fuck.
Man, I think that's a personal, whatever your sobriety is good for, you know, if you're not doing what you're doing and acting how you're acting, I think that's, you know, where's the accountability? Like, do you have to sign in? I mean, like, who's measuring this? You know, because I've had this conversation with other people, and it's like, you know, this is such a personal thing, and you know,
no, absolutely right. And I don't slight anybody, you know, but I did a lot. I did AA for a lot of years. My dad's got sober in 73, so I've been around. John, and I'm no, you know, this is, I'm not trying to blow anyone's anonymity. That is, you know, they're all, anybody I'm going to name check is totally okay with, you know, I know it's like, what's happened here stays here, here, here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But John's been sober for years and he's a big, you know, he's very big in the AA world. And my dad, you know, it was really cool going to meetings with my dad and, you know, yeah. So, but I don't drink. It's been 14 years.
Good for you, man. So that what was your trigger, man? What was like rock bottom again, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it? What was the, you know,
it was really, I call it spiritual malady. I needed a fucking soul enema. I was, I'd gone through a relationship that I really wanted to work and was very serious about, and it fell apart. And I just thought to myself, you know, I've tried everything but getting sober. Oh, and my whole thing was like, I'm just going to stop drinking and smoking weed for 2 months, two weeks, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I started doing it, and I didn't go to meetings for probably I probably didn't go to meetings for the first until like 3 or 4 months into it. I actually went to an acupuncturist, and I was cause Goldfinger we would tour, and then we would take breaks cause John was producing, and I was kind of at the spot where I was like, you know, his producing career took off and right when all this stuff was going on, and he was like putting the band on hold. And I was like, fuck, you know, you're just at that spot. Like, what am I doing? And I'm like, you know, fuck it. And I got sober when I was living up in Portland in 2005, March. And the funny thing is, even when I was a kid, I remember even saying before I turned 21, just because, you know, my dad was sober and everything. And I just remember telling my friends, I'm going, yeah, I'm going to be in AA probably when I get older. Before I was even 21, I remember saying that.
Well, because if you grew up with watching somebody else, you kind of knew the trajectory.
Well, I knew the trajectory, you know, of my drinking too. Yeah. And to be honest with you, I didn't think I was going to make it to 30. Wow. I honestly was like, yeah, I'll probably burn out before I hit 30. And then I hit 30 and I was like, fuck, I'm still here. Son of a bitch. And then, you know, Goldfinger, two of the guys in that band were sober.
So that helped a lot, I bet.
And I had a lot of friends. Even in the Love Hogs, there was a couple guys, you know, that were sober. And I watched those dudes really clean their shit up and get their act together. And I was like, fuck. And I want, you know, my dad was sober. And I was like, my dad was always like, you know, when you're ready, I'm saving you a seat. All my friends were like, saving you a seat, bro. Cause I'd show up to rehearsals fucking green, man. Cause I just went out and tied one on. I mean, to the point of where I was like, as about to throw up in pre-production for records, I was just like fucking just hammered, man. Just,
oh man.
I looked like a fucking bag of, you know, mashed assholes. And I was just like, oh, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep doing this. Why do I keep doing this? What the fuck am I doing? I wake up the next day and go, I'd have to ask the sober dudes in the band. One of the guys would hang out with the party people and, you know, just hang out and not drink and just kind of absorb it all. And, you know, some people are like, they can do it and hang out with it. And other people are like, I got to get away from this shit. It's a trigger.
Yeah, of course.
So I remember getting up one day in Tucson for a festival, just fucking like going, looking at the guitar player going, did I do coke last night? And he goes, oh yeah. And I'm like, fuck, I don't even fucking remember. And then having to play this festival at 3:00 in the afternoon, just fucking green in like 100 degree heat in fucking Tucson outdoors. And I'm just like, what? And I remember I turned around, I was about to walk on stage, and some fucking crew guy from the fucking Long Beach Drunk All-Stars or the Long Beach Dub All-Stars threw his fucking lid from his fucking one of the cabinets, threw the lid down in front of me. I'm walking out on stage in front of fucking, you know, 10,000 people. And I turn around green with my sunglasses on and I don't see this fucking lid for this case. I fucking eat shit on a cement stage. Bloody knees. Yeah. I go on and half the crew guys are snickering. And I honestly wanted to take my bass off and bash this fucking guy's skull in for doing that as he's snickering at me the fuck. And I walk on stage, blood running down my knees, play a fucking half an hour set, high octane punk rock shit, jumping around green, sweating cocaine and alcohol out of my system.
God.
And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? So probably like, you know, another year or two after that, I got sober.
Wow.
But it's kind of like shit like that. I ended, ended up like doing that thing where it was like, I think I should probably stop, but I think I'm okay. And then I started, cause I sang a lot of the background vocals with Goldfinger. So I'm up drinking all night, smoking a shit ton of weed. And then I would do, I would drink throat coat tea for my voice because I did all the harmonies, Goldfinger, and doing throat coat. And I'm thinking, well, this throat coat tea is really good, but you know what would really burn this shit off is if I put a little bit of Malibu rum in this. So I'm drinking like, dude, and it's just one of those things. Cause I was like, I'll never smoke weed before I play. I'll never smoke weed before I play. I'll never drink before I play. And I'm fucking smoking weed during the day, taking a nap to burn the weed off. And then I started doing the throat coat and I started putting Malibu rum in it. And I was like, what the fuck? And I was going on stage and I'm telling you, as a musician, all you have is your reputation. That's all you fucking got, man. Yeah. And reputation is as fragile as a goddamn eggshell. You fuck your reputation up and nobody will fucking hire you anymore. And no matter if it's personality, whatever the fuck it is. Mm. And I'm like, sooner or later, I'm going to start fucking my reputation up as a musician. And we had a break. And I was like, you know what? I'm fucking done. I'm taking a break. I'm going to just see how I do. And like I said, John, the singer for Goldfinger, he's been sober for years, still sober. I think he got like 28 years or something crazy. And I used to drink with him and he is better off not drinking. Trust you me. He'd be dead if he didn't stop.
Yeah.
I mean, I watched him. Even as a drinker, I was like, dude, you need to quit. And you know, I came back and did that tour a couple weeks, 3 weeks. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't smoking weed. And I remember him turning around going, dude, your fucking vocals sound amazing. He's like, what's going on? Why are you singing so much better? And I'm like, quit smoking pot, quit drinking. He's like, dude, you sound great. And then I just kept going, and I started going to meetings, and, you know, I got a sponsor, Jim, my buddy Jim, who's fucking great. And you know, I just kept doing it, and I felt like I felt like completely psycho and lost. It took me about a year to feel like a normal human being again. And I just kept doing it. I kept going to meetings, and, you know, there's a certain, I know this sounds cliche, but there's a certain magic about one alcoholic helping out another alcoholic. I don't know what it is, but it fucking really worked. It worked for me. And, you know, I got some clarity in my life, and it fucking worked.
Man, I'm really happy for you. Thank you for sharing that, man.
I don't want to start drinking again. And like I said, disclaimer on the weed.
Oh, man, don't waste your time on that. That's,
I know, but yeah. There is a total like AA. There's a certain thing. It really does ruin. I've talked to a bunch of people that have gone out and come back in, and they're like, fucking AA, man. It ruined me for drinking, man. Fuck. You know, they'll go out and they'll come back in. And I've also seen a lot of people go out and lose everything and lose their lives.
How did your dad, do you still go to meetings?
I haven't gone in a while, but all of my friends and everybody's like, hey, you know, without blowing anonymity, you know, Buck Cherry, all those guys are sober.
That's
all of
great.
Them. And I know they don't give a fuck. Who knows? I mean, you know, I know we have songs about cocaine and all this shit, but you know, those songs are written from a realistic place. We have a song called Whiskey in the Morning, and Josh wrote that about fucking, and he even says, you know, a lot of people, like in the middle of the song, we have this breakdown where it's just drums and bass, and there's a little bit of guitar in there. And he says, you know, a lot of people think this is a song about glorifying drinking, and he's all, it's not, it was a cry for help. And he kind of puts a disclaimer on it. And, you know, a lot of our songs are written from a place of knowing. It's not, well, you guys don't even drink. How can you write a song about being drunk? And it's like, dude, we were more fucked up than all you and your fucking friends. I mean, you know, I knew Stevie. Me, Stevie and I drank together. I watched him go and crash and burn. He moved back to Chicago. I'm not going to tell his story, but, you know, he's fucking 18 years sober now.
That's great.
Fucking great. You know, I knew who Kevin was back in the day, and he hung out with a lot of Stevie, you know, a lot of really rough, you know, undesirable characters. And, you know, we were all, you know, I don't want to say malcontents, but we were definitely drunken pugilists, all of us. So
two questions about that, and I'll put it to bed. How did your dad feel, or what was it once you started cleaning up? And you connected with your dad. That must have been pretty cool, I would imagine.
It was great. And, you know, my dad and I were always tight. We've always been tight anyways. But it was pretty cool going. I would go to meetings when I moved back up here, when he was still living up here. I'd go to his home meetings. And, it was definitely a lot of, you know, heartwarming moment.
Oh, moments. Yeah, of course. I could see
you
that.
Know, it was fucking great. Yeah.
Well, as a dad, I can definitely see that. I mean, I'm not a guy who's gotten sober. Thank God I haven't had, but, you know, anytime your child overcomes something, it's a very, you know, you're proud of him and you want to, you know, be around him when feeling, you know,
it was amazing. You know, my dad, you know, and he even said in some of the meetings we'd go to, sorry, I gotta have some more coffee here. He even said, you know, when it was his turn to share, that he's like, you know, I didn't even know he had a problem. You know, because for all he knew, I was fine because I was really good at hiding how miserable I was.
Right.
You know, and like I said, it really was a spiritual malady. And he even had some of my friends go, you know, I didn't think you had a problem. I'm like, Well, yeah, because you weren't there when I was shitting blood and wiping it off my ass. You know, you didn't feel these pains of like somebody stabbing me in the intestines with a fucking rusty fucking knife. You know, you didn't know. I didn't tell you about that stuff. It messed my health up a lot. I mean, back then, I mean, I'm grateful, you know, that I've not have as many internal issues as I had. And, you know, later in the last couple of years did have some issues, but it was not alcohol related.
Which is a good time to switch to the next thing I mentioned in the beginning. You beat cancer. And
yes, I had leukemia.
Yeah. What kind of leukemia is that? How did you discover it? And how's your health doing now?
Well, it's a blood cancer. I just went in 2 days ago, and for my annual, I think I'm at every 3 months I go now. I've been in remission for, what year is this? 2016? No, wait. Fuck, I don't even remember, dude. How sad is that? It's been about 2.5, 3. I think we're coming up on 3 years.
That's great.
Since my diagnosis. Actually, shit. I think it's 3 years, June 9th, I want to say. How did I discover it? Well, we were on tour. So my birthday's in April. I had my birthday in April, and then a couple of weeks after my birthday, I was like, I remember like why my girl at the time was like, hey, well, I want to go down to the Sandy River, and this is where I grew up. I grew up around here, and here it was in Troutdale, I think. Or no, Gresham and Troutdale, and so I want to go.
That's
there.
Oregon.
Yeah, in Oregon, and I just moved back to Oregon early 16, right? I think right before I got diagnosed, or at the end of 15, I moved here. I was 15, and I remember walking back up to the car and going up these little sand dunes. And I was like, had trouble breathing. And I was like, the fuck, why am I so winded? And I'm like, I know I just had a birthday and I was approaching, I just turned 49 at the time. And I was just like, wow, this is weird. And then we went, did some stuff. And then we stopped off. She's like, oh, I want to stop at this Ross Dress for Less. They have really cool stuff in here. And I remember going like, you know, I feel like I'm kind of getting sick. I'm like, I don't feel that good. I'm going to go stand outside and get some fresh air. And then I was getting ready to leave on tour like a week later. And then we left for that tour May, I want to say 4th-ish, I'm guessing. And we went on that tour. And I remember telling my tour manager, Steve Shaw, I remember telling him, going, Steve, I don't feel right. There's something wrong with me, but I'm not quite sure. And I'm like, I feel a little winded half the time and just generally low energy. And then we got on tour and it kept going and it started getting worse. And I was like, man, I was going on stage. I was just dragging ass. We played for an hour and 20 minutes and I'm getting up there. You know, we're playing in the South in the fucking heat, played this venue. One of the days he actually was like, fuck it, you're missing the meet and greet. He called me. He had the runner come take me to a urgent care. He's like, I'm worried about you. You don't look good. Your colors
are that bad.
So he sent me to urgent care. And, you know, we play like 4 or 5 times a week. You know what I mean? And I'm like, I'm just dragging ass. I'm waking up all sweat drenched and shit. And I remember we played the Surf Ballroom in Clearly, it's the last place Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens played before their plane went down. And I remember we played a Google film that it was live on Google, and my really good buddy Tommy, who plays in my ACDC, I got an ACDC cover band that's fucking killing up here. So good. And Doug Rappaport from Edgar Winter's group, too.
I had Doug on here.
Doug's awesome. Just rehearsed because we're actually opening for Buck Cherry June 11th when we play up here.
So you're opening for yourself.
Yeah, but I've done that. I mean, I'm one of those dudes. Cool. I'm a double dipper. I love to just play. That's but anyways, I remember Tommy watching that going, "What'd you think?" And he just looked at me and he goes, he didn't look at me. He actually called me on the phone. He goes, "You don't look good, dude. You look pale." I'm like, "Fuck you. Thanks." You know what I mean? So anyways, they threw me in there and I went to the urgent care. It was somewhere in Ohio or Illinois, middle America. And they did everything but take my fucking blood.
Oh my God. So they found nothing.
Oh, you probably have bronchitis. Here's some Z-Pack. Here's some shit for your bronch. Because I had a little cough going. Anyways, long story longer. Let's cut to Cooksville, Tennessee, or as I like to call it, Cooksville. And I was going to be home in about 5 days. And I called up. Ironically, I didn't get insurance till about 6 months earlier because it was before the whole Obamacare penalty thing and all that shit.
Yeah.
And all the guys were like, "You got to get insurance. What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "I'm never sick. Fuck you." Cause I wasn't. And so I ended up getting insurance and, ended up getting insurance and moving to Portland proper. I was living out in the boonies, and which will come into play later. And so I, was in Cooksville and I called up and I said, "Hey, I want to make an appointment to get my panels done." And they were like, "Oh, okay." And it was that Thursday. I don't know how I remember this shit. And I flew home on Saturday, got my blood taken Monday, got a root canal on Tuesday, and got a phone call on Wednesday because I was like, "Oh, man, it's just," I started feeling even worse. And I started getting a really bad gut feeling because I'm like, "This is not fucking Irie. I don't know what's going on. This is not good." I remember taking a nap and then I get up and I walk out and I just gotten home and from being on tour. Like I said, it was Wednesday and I live right next door to Auto Sausage Kitchen and they set up outside. They sell hot dogs and stuff. It's a great, they're actually my landlords. They own the house I live in. And I remember walking in, this kid, Travis, there was nobody around. It was right before they were closing and he was sitting out there and he looks at me and he goes, "You just get back from tour?" And I'm all, "Yeah." And he goes, "You look like shit." And I went, I just looked at him and I go,
50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong, right?
Dude, I just looked at him and I go, "I feel like shit." And I came home and I'm like, "Fuck, what's up? These motherfuckers need to call me." And my girl showed up the afternoon that Wednesday and my phone rang at about 3 o'clock and they do that whole rope-a-dope on you. "Hi, it's Brittany from, we have your blood panels back. We'd love to come in and have to talk to you about them." And I just remember looking at my chick. I just turned around to her and I mouthed to her, "I'm fucked."
Yeah. When they tell you to come in, it's never good. It's
yeah. Yeah. And so she's like, "Well, we have an appointment for you at 6. And I'm like, 6 o'clock? Fuck, what the fuck? Who does a clinic appointment at 6 o'clock? They close at 6.
Yeah, that's not good.
And so I go, "You got anything sooner?" She's like, "We have one in 20 minutes. I'm all, "I'll be there."
Yeah.
Fucking grabbed her, raced down there, you know, check in. You know, I go in by myself. And they just totally fucking rope-a-doped me the whole time. "Oh my God. Oh, what are you? Oh, Buck Cherry. We love Buck Cherry. Bada bada bing." And I go in there and I sit down and she's just all chipper and giddy. And then she goes, "So let's talk about your test results."
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at you, but it's it
gets better.
Oh my God.
And I look at her and I go,
"Did you take the class on communication in a medical situation?"
I go and I look at her and I go, "Okay, let's talk about them." And she just sits there and fucking stares at me.
God, it's not it's not enough anxiety without this with this circus here.
The back of my mind, I'm thinking, "All right, what's up, bitch?" You know what I mean? Tell me. And so,
God.
She just looks at me and she goes, "Not good." No. She didn't say
God.
Shit. She didn't say not good. I go, "Not good, hon." She goes, not good, and fucking stares at me some more. And I'm just like going, oh, you fucking
God,
make me fucking get the goddamn pliers out and yank it out of you. Fucking what kind?
This isn't like a reveal for like you've won a vacation. You know, I mean, this is like
fucking Howie Mandel. What's going on here? So anyways, I go and I just look at her and I go, like, cancer not good? And she goes, yeah. And she hands me the sheet. She's all, you've got AML leukemia. Bada bing, bada boom, bam, bam. And I'm looking at her.
And let me guess, after leukemia, you didn't hear anything because you like, you did, yeah.
And she's talking to me and I start thinking, I just look at her and I go, are you fucking kidding me? I was pissed. She goes, no, I'm serious. So, but your doctor is, I'm like going, I'm still like, you're right. I'm not hearing. And I just go, I'm going on tour in fucking 2 days. I can't fucking. She's like, you're not going anywhere. You're packing a bag 4 to 6 weeks. We're checking you into the hospital tomorrow. You're getting a bone marrow biopsy. And then we're starting aggressive chemo on you that day. Oh, and I just looked at her and went, fuck.
Wait a minute. This was an actual doctor speaking to you? I thought it was like a.
The clinic. This is the fucking chick that preps you for the doctor. This is the, I got to give you bad news chick. This is the fucking. This is the, you're going to die henchman.
Yeah. How would they have somebody a little, not more like up the food chain, just giving you that news? Yeah.
Pissed about the way it was all handled. But wow. I will tell you this. And then I had to go grab my girl who was sitting down in the.
Oh, you were in there alone.
Yeah. And then I walk in, I grab her by the hand. I don't say fuck all. I go sit in my car. I sit down and we'd only been dating a few months. And I look at her and I go, I got fucking leukemia. And she doesn't say anything. And I go, I know we've only been dating four or five months. I'm like, I'm going to give you the out right now. If you want to fucking bail, you can bail. I'm not going to get bad. This is going to get fucked. I don't know what's going to happen. And she just looked at me and she goes, I'm not going anywhere. And I was just like, okay, I got to call my band because I was flying out Friday. It was Wednesday. And I called my guitar player at the time, Keith, who's not in the band anymore. And I called Keith and I go, Keith, I'm not doing this next tour. And he's like, what? Why not? And I'm like, I got fucking leukemia. I'm checking into the hospital tomorrow, dude. And he goes, what? And I'm like going, yeah. And he goes, okay. We'll deal with it. He's all, do what you got to do. Hit me back later. Don't sweat it. And I was just like, fuck. So anyways, you know, it was a long night. And here I am now.
Wow. Oh, my God.
God bless you. Fucking stuck through the whole thing.
So first of all, I'm really happy you're here now, of course.
Me too.
So you went in for aggressive chemo treatment. Does that take right away, or what is that process like?
I went into remission after the first fucking round, but they gave me two bags. Right, I had to get pick lines. I got a pick line in my, which they go in through your bicep. The
is that like a port?
It's like a port. The port's in your chest, right?
Yeah,
in here.
Yeah, right.
I got a pick line, which is in your bicep.
Okay.
It goes right in your main artery, right above your heart valve, and they just start fucking pumping. They get two. I had two little connectors, spouts that screw on, so they can put, you know, two bags of chemo. They did two bags of chemo right off the bat.
Well, when you're younger, I know they do it because you're considered young to have that, even at, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
50 totally. or 48.
The doctor told me, he goes, look, he saw. You're young, you're healthy. He's like, you got a good shot of beating this. And he goes, on top of that, he goes, you know, they run a DNA scan. He's all, you're in the top tier DNA to beat this, for this shit to go away.
Oh, that's great.
And I was like, fuck it, let's do this shit. And I had one of those moments where I was laying there and I'm like going, man, this is some fucked up shit right here. And I just went, you know what? I was actually playing bass. I had my roommate bring a bass down. Ovation actually sent me an acoustic bass. It was supposed to come in weeks ago, and it's showed up 2 days into my treatment. I have my roommate bring it in for me, and I was sitting there fucking playing bass, and I'm just sitting there. I'm like going, you know what? I'm not fucking done playing bass. I want to play bass some more. I'm like, I'm beating this shit. Fuck this shit. And it's always kind of been my mentality. Oh, you're too small to play football? Fuck you. You know what I mean? I'm three-year letterman. I was the tiniest guy out there. I think about it now, and I'm like, what is wrong with me? Like 28. My mom used to go, and like, she's like, I can't watch. You're so small. What are you doing? Why did I let you play? And
dude, I'm liking you more and more. This is great, honestly.
I'm one of those guys that's like, you know, and I'm not comparing to myself to Michael Jordan because I'm no Michael Jordan, but I remember watching the Bulls, and I remember when he would get pissed off.
Oh, or sick, it's over for the other team.
And I'm like, that's my mentality. I'm like, oh, really, motherfucker? Fuck you.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I powered through it. I moved my treatments up earlier. The doctor was like, you're doing great. He's like, you want to wait another week to start your next round of chemo? I'm all, hell no. I was back out on tour 5 months later. Wow. And then the band fell apart and almost broke up. I was like, you fucking asshole.
Yeah, man, I'm not going through this shit to have a breakup. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, fortunately, everything worked out for the band and it's fucking great. And
well, for you, forget that. Man.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, I was just like, I'm not done playing bass. I want to play bass.
I'm the same way, man. Righteous indignation is a big motivation for me.
Boom. That is a great fucking term.
Yeah, it is, because it's, you know, tell me or imply that I'm less than, or I shouldn't, or why this didn't happen. And then I'm like, fuck you. You watched. I'm now going to dig in my heels and
boom,
motherfucker kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. That's always been my my mentality.
I'm really so. And you're 3 years clean now, or mission free. Good for you, man. That's really cool.
Whoever you choose to praise,
pray. Yeah, totally, man.
I'm fucking grateful. I had such a public outpouring that my heart still swells up when I think about it. Every time I read the news and want to fucking just go like, what in the fuck is going on with this fucking planet? I think about it. I had so many people, just so much positive vibes and outpouring, and I just go, you know what? There is good in the world. You know?
Wow. Wow, that's a heavy thing to go through. I went through, not me, my wife had cancer many years ago, so I went through, you know, I didn't go through it, but I know how.
So many people. I mean, I don't know anybody that hasn't been touched. Yeah. I lost my mother to aggressive brain cancer. I watched.
Oh, wow.
Another reason that, not to interrupt your story.
No, man. This is your interview.
Another reason I watched my mom get diagnosed and in 7 weeks was gone. And I watched that fucking crushed me more than anything has ever crushed me in my life. And so when I was like to watch my mom go through that and just, I mean, the diagnosis was a fucking, you know, it was a death sentence. To watch that and when I got diagnosed, I was like, oh, fuck it. I've already had my soul crushed. This is going to be, if I die, I don't care. Watching my mom go through that was, you know, more debilitating than anything I've ever gone through in my life. And I was just like, you know, even more than fucking going through AA, you know, addiction, all that shit. Watching her go through that crushed me. It fucking destroyed everyone. My mom was the linchpin to my family. And to, you know, go through that, I was like, fuck cancer. I can beat this shit. Fuck it. And if I don't, man, I had such a good run. I've traveled the world. I mean, my passport's like that freaking thick. I've got pages added. I'm like, I had a good run. I've done almost, you know, the majority of the things I wanted to do. You know, I was like, fuck it. You know, watching my mom go through that. So, you know, everybody's been hammered by cancer in one way or another.
Or addiction. So,
What? Your wife's? I'm glad she fucking kicked its ass. Cause it sounds like she did.
Oh, she did, and she was. Yeah, she did, and she's a wonderful person, and yeah, I understand what that's like, man. Wow, yeah. Dude, that was. Thank you for sharing that. And if I was there, I'd give you a hug right now.
Probably if you did.
Yeah, man. That's. Thank you. I'm so happy everything's good, though, man. Really.
Thank you.
Wow. You know, often I never know where these interviews are going to go. Sometimes I give something to the person I'm talking to, and sometimes they give something to me, which you just gave something to me. And it's always so, you know, inspiring to hear something like that. And it really, just your whole attitude about everything, it's really, and I think you have to be like that. You can't knuckle down. You have to be like, you know, I'm going to win. You know, you may not, but if you don't think like that, I don't think your chances are as good.
I agree. Absolutely. Attitude is fucking so important. Like, it really, like, I watched this thing on YouTube, and this Japanese doctor took three separate, and I don't know if it's bullshit or not, because I didn't really follow up on it, but you know how you scroll through YouTube, and he took three separate things of rice in water. He put them in water, and each one he did a different thing to the rice. One of them he would go up to and like tell it horrible, hurtful, hateful. You're terrible. You suck. And throw negative shit at it. And this was a while ago. I looked at this. One of them, he was like kind of benign. And the other one, he like gave positive reinforcement to. And I swear to God, and I don't know if this is bullshit, but it still instilled to me like, wow, that the one he was positive to was like super flourished and was like good and clear.
Yeah.
And the other one was kind of milky. And the one that had the negative shit at it was just black and dark and disgusting. And I'm like going, well, even if this is bullshit, I still buy into the ideology of it.
No, I agree with you. Energy is real, man. You know, and it's just like you get around certain people and their energy is fucking awful and you feel literally ill when you're around them. And other times you get around people, it's like, wow, man, you know, when I have more energy, I feel better than, you know, it's like, that's why therapy is so helpful. Sometimes you go there and you get a little bit of more energy than, or whatever the shit was weighing you down, you unloaded it and it's like, oh, I'm free now, you know?
I absolutely agree. 100%. That's gotten me through everything in life.
It's funny you say that, because the thing that Ann said to me, my wife, she said what happened was, because they diagnosed her stage 4. So it was like, fuck, not if, but when. And she was sitting in the hospital, and the night before she was supposed to have her surgery or have start chemo, I think, or both, she said, you know, Craig, I spoke to my grandmother who was dead, and I thought of her, and just something happened where all of a sudden I said, you know what, I'm going to be okay. And I really believed that. And then the next morning I get a phone call from the doctor. And she goes, Craig, I don't, you know, Ann was all like nervous, and she's, could you just understand what he's saying? I don't get it. So I'm like, you know, hey, and I'm pretty good with, you know, I'm interested in understand medical science stuff. But, and basically he said, we've never seen this before. We canceled chemo. This has been, you know, whatever. There was a bunch of things that were like, it was like a miracle, man, you know?
That's fucking incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, she still had to have surgery and, you know, a lot of stuff, but, so I think I'm a firm believer in that attitude stuff about everything in life, you know?
Dude, so. I can't tell you. I mean, you know, my mom had no shot. It was, it's called geoglossoma. It was aggressive. And we were just hopeful. We knew it was a fucking death sentence. But you know, I think that if there's a fighting fucking chance, attitude is so vital, and positive reinforcement and vibe, and just, you know, I can't say enough about it. And you know, I get dark. I'm one of these, I call myself psychoglycemic. I'm one of these guys that, like, I am Joe Pesci. Hey, what are you? When I don't eat, I turn into freaking Joe Pesci. Like, it's, I just feel like that scene where he's stabbing the guy that didn't die in the trunk.
Yeah.
Like, I just turn into that character.
Yeah.
But when I've eaten and had a little bit of sleep, man, I'm so on point. So I have to be very, very conscious of that.
Yeah. But
you're absolutely right, man. Positive PMA is vital.
Yeah.
Because I mean, look what I chose to do. Everybody, you know, we play Vegas a lot. We'll do stuff. Oh, you're going to go gamble? And I just look at people and I go, I chose music as a career. Don't you think that was a big enough
gamble? That's enough gamble. Yeah, man.
Come on. Like, what do you want from me?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just like, you know. But yeah.
Well, thank you, man. I'm so happy everything's great.
Attitude is everything.
Thank you so much for sharing all that, man. I'm really happy everything's and on all fronts, man. You're like a really great example. And I hope, and let me tell you, especially with the addiction stuff, I've had so many people come on and share stories about getting sober that I had tons of messages coming in from listeners that are like, hey, man, I'm really struggling. And I listened to so-and-so's interview. It helped me. And so I wound up making a list on YouTube, a playlist for musicians getting sober. It's by far the most popular playlist that gets played of all the shows. Wow. Yeah. People are really, you know, inspired by that. You know, like you said, this fellowship in getting sober, man, it's easier, you know?
There really is something about, you know, one alcoholic helping another alcoholic that is just, there's some weird, magical, kinetic, you know, I don't know. It's, you know, maybe it's a lot like the screaming at the rice or being caring to the rice and just letting go of a lot of bullshit. And, you know, it gives you, the other thing is I think that's really key is you have to take accountability for your actions.
Oh, of course.
It makes, you know, I know it's a 12-step program, but I believe if you cut out the addictive part of it and just did, you know, the 5 or 6 steps, everybody could use it.
It's God, there's so much good stuff in there. Yeah. Are you kidding me? I agree.
Like the accountability part alone, I feel like there's so many people out there that have zero fucking accountability. That they're just like, fuck you, I want what I want. And they just lob hand grenades in everybody's fucking garden and just plow through life, just fucking shit up and just have no accountability whatsoever, which a lot of addicts do. And this, you know, you have to do a fearless moral inventory. And I think most people are afraid of that. Nobody wants to do a moral inventory of people you fucked over, shitty stuff you've done. The funny thing about addiction is, you know, when I did my 4th step,
which is
writing a fearless moral inventory of everyone you've wronged, what your part is in it, you know, all that. When I did that, I had a fucking light bulb moment in my life that I went, oh my God, everybody that I'm resentful to, because you write your resentments down. And then what your part in it was. And when you got to write down what your part in that resentment is, wow. Talk about what a realization of, oh my God, I'm the one that's been fucking it up the whole time. Son of
wow.
a bitch. And then those resentments, a large majority of them turned into 5th steps, which is making amends. I'm just like going like that ex-girlfriend. And I was like, fuck you. I hate you. You didn't love me. Was, well, what was your part in it? Oh, well, I was a drunken pugilist. I was crabby. I was a hungover dick. I was a fucking, you know, whatever, jealous turd, whatever.
Yeah.
Talk about a fucking light bulb, life-changing moment. And I tell that everybody that goes to AA, I'm all, you don't do your 4th and 5th step. Really hard to stay sober for any amount of time.
There's so much good stuff. I had to go to NA Naranon for a while for something that I can't really talk about on the air, but I'll tell you afterwards. But they were reading the you know, one of the many books, and they said one thing, and it changed my life. The passage started, it said, "What's so important about being right?" And I was like, you know, I was ready to hear that, and I was like, oh my God. That just took so much stress, not ever worrying about that again, because I realized that thing that I wanted to be right, because I'm not the kind of person like, oh, I'll show you, but I'm very, my bar on myself is stupid and unforgiving.
Yep.
And so like, it was like so liberating. It was like a 1,000,000-pound weight lifted off my shoulder, and it like improved my relationship with pretty much every human being that I ever came into contact with, because being right was so unimportant to me now. The I realize relationships are what's important, and I don't give a shit about being right. And I realized that was a, you know, my shit that was in there, you know? And so there's great, I don't know why they don't teach, you know, their principles of, because nobody has, and it's worse now because of the fucking cell phones. None of these kids, because I've raised three of them, you know, and my older two are much different than my daughter, who's 10 years younger. My older two are 29 and 27, and they're like, thank God I didn't grow up with a cell phone, Dad. Especially right. My older one, he's like cognizant of, and they just don't have the coping skills, you know, but they need courses like this to, because that's what you need to get along in the world, coping skills, man, you know?
Yep, you're absolutely. Well, it's funny that you say that, because, well, a lot of my great sayings that I have came from AA, and one of them is, and I don't know if it's particularly an AA saying, but it is very vital, and it rings out with exactly what you just said. Would you rather be right, or would you rather be happy?
Yeah, right. Rather be fucking happy.
And one of my other key ones from AA is principles before personalities, which means basically don't worry about the personalities in there. Worry about the principles.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter anywhere in life that you go, there's going to be some motherfucker that is going to just play an ugly chord with you.
Yes.
And you just got to be like, we got to deal with the principles here, not the personalities. Because let's be honest, it's not the fucking Glee Club. It's not where the just kids go.
It's
hang
not
out,
the fucking right? Glee Club, dude. That is so funny, but very true.
People that can't control their fucking habits go.
That is great.
But I have also seen so many people change from an ugly poisoned bud into a beautiful fucking flower. So.
That's so cool.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, because that was good. That really resonated with me, because what happened with me is like, even things and stuff I'd argue with my wife, I was always like, oh, well, I want to show you. And I gave all that up. And what it happened was it became more about, hey, let's, how do we resolve this? And then I noticed that she became much, and even now, this is, you know, 10 years later, like if we argue it, it's like, you know, well, plus we've been old enough and been together long enough. It's like, let's just fucking fix this immediately. You know, it's not a big deal. Like whoever has to throw out an olive branch, like, hey, hon, let's give me a hug and let's fix this right now, you know, which is like a lot easier than proving a point, because it really doesn't do much for anybody, you know? So.
Right. Uh-oh.
Man.
Turn the phone on. I charged the phone. Okay. Got it.
So let's talk about music for a minute. first record you ever got, you ever bought on your own?
First record or first 8-track?
You were into 8-tracks?
Dude, I'm 52.
I'm 55. Records.
You have to put the MacBook underneath it to keep it up so it wouldn't warble, because it would.
I didn't have an 8-track. I just had LPs.
We had one of those consoles that had an 8-track in it too. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
I bought two. I think I was. Fuck! How old was I? I think I was 11. 10, 11. Now I had stuff, but the first ones I bought, you ready?
Uh-huh.
The Monkees' Greatest Hits.
Awesome.
Was on 8-track.
That's a great record.
Vinyl I ever bought was Ace Frehley's solo album.
Interesting. That's an interesting one. Very cool. I've had a couple of people say they bought like a Ace Frehley record.
Yep. I just bought it. I don't know why I bought his. His is still the best.
That's funny.
It's still a great record. I'll still listen to it. I think I still have it.
That's funny. Top three or four Desert Island discs.
Today?
Just for now. Yeah, of course. It's today? I can ask you that in 20 minutes, it'll be a different answer.
Oh, jeez. Highway to Hell, AC/DC. Maybe Physical Graffiti, Led Zeppelin.
That's a great record, man.
This shit that's popping into my head. There's so much more. And I'm gonna be, fuck, why didn't I say that? Maybe right now, today, maybe Sade Pride.
Interesting.
And also Fear the Record.
What?
The band Fear the Record.
Okay.
The band I ended up playing in, which ironically was my favorite punk band. And when I did that MD45 record, it's funny because everybody's like, oh my God, you got to play with Dave Mustaine. And I'm like, yeah, Dave Mustaine's cool. But dude, I was so nervous to talk to Lee. Lee was like I was just like, huh. I remember talking to Jimmy. He's like, have you talked to Lee yet? And he goes, oh yeah, he's great. You should talk to him. And I'm like, it's Lee Ving. Like he was like, you know, and ironically got the Fear gig.
So was that the first, was that the only time you've been starstruck?
No, here's a funny one. When I was in LA, still living in LA before I moved back up here, one of my ex-girlfriends, we went to the Groundlings.
What is that? And, is that a club?
It's actually, it is a
comedy. Sorry, man. I don't know anything.
It's a comedy troupe in Melrose.
Okay.
It's a comedy troupe on Melrose in LA. I think a lot of comedians come out of there or show up. I met, what's his name now? I'm forgetting his name. He played Stevie Janowski on Eastbound and Down. He was Kenny fucking Powers' little right hand.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Something little. I want to say Steve Little, but that's my buddy's name.
I know who you're talking about.
I met him. She like pulled it off to where he was doing one of these things because I'm a huge Eastbound and Down fan.
That was a great show.
I get more starstruck by like non-musicians.
Okay.
Musicians, I'm like, yeah, I'm a musician too. Let's rock. You know what I mean? Whatever. I'm like, cool. But it's like people that aren't musicians that I like it's some of these weird like actor types that nobody's like, who the fuck is that? I'm like, oh my God, are you kidding me? It's the dude that played Pulp the Mob Boy from the Toxic Avenger. Like just all these weird, stupid, benign fucking people that nobody knows. Like character actors, I get like, I fucking loved you and he's bound. And my girlfriend, she introduced me to him and we took pictures and she goes, that's the first time I've ever seen you clam up in front of anybody. And I'm like, but he's bound and down. I was like obsessed with he's bound and down.
That was a great show.
Like Danny McBride was my man crush forever. If I would have met him, I probably would have peed my pants.
Yeah, I like that show. My wife was horrified that I liked that show. that's such a guy show.
I love extreme crazy shit like that. It's so unbelievable. Like Married with Children is the same thing. I'm like, I can't believe you can watch Married with Children. It's so degrading and blah. I'm like, it's comedy. It's funny. Of course, it's not real.
Very guy. You're a great player, and you've played with so many good players. Name a couple of guitar players you've really enjoyed jamming with.
Oh, geez. So many. Paul, obviously. Yeah, Doug Rapoport. Doug's amazing. Yeah, here's a guy that doesn't get enough. Doesn't get enough name checking unless you're an LA dude and know him. I played with this guy, Steve Hufstetter. I was in this band Shrine for a while. He played with the Dickies and the Crusados and the Plugs. And I think he's actually, like, you know, Tito and Tarantula that do a lot of the Robert Rodriguez music. Mm-hmm. Steve played guitar in a lot of that. He played there's a movie that a lot of people don't know called Repo Man.
Oh yeah. With Charlie Sheen?
Sheen's brother.
Yeah. Emilio Estevez. Yeah.
And Steve played a lot of the twangy guitar in that, and all the instrumental shit. And sorry, I'm getting text messages here.
All good, man.
He played guitar on that. Steve is a fucking phenomenal guitar player. So good. I'm trying to think. I know there's somebody. You know who I got to play with? Who I was just like, didn't really know that much about at the time, and then later on was like, holy fuck. Steve Hunter.
I got him coming on my show next month.
Steve Hunter. Yeah. He lives in Spain now.
Yeah.
Steve,
he's amazing, man.
It was him.
Wow. Yeah.
Complete fluke.
When did you play with him? He's such an incredible player, man.
Oh, amazing. We were hired guns for a project in the fucking 90s. I was just like, wow, this guy's really good. And then I went and like, oh, fuck, holy shit, I'm playing with Steve Hunter.
Yeah. It's one of
those, you know, where you like play with these dudes, you don't know who they are. You know, I did a lot of Paul's, I did a couple of his summer camps, and he had like Guthrie Govan on it. Yeah. And,
he's coming on my show soon. So,
Oh shit. Why am I forgetting his name? I just ran into him at the NAMM show. He was in Danger. And
Andy Timmons.
Yeah. Andy was great. Yeah.
He's been on.
Fuck. So many good guitar players. You know, I played with these blues cats. JJ Holiday was great. He played slide open tuning. He played with like Bob Dylan and Etta James. It's kind of like the guys that aren't rock dudes are the ones I tend to remember a little bit more because I played with so many awesome rock guitar players. I've been really fortunate. I mean, I've played with some really great dudes. I know once we get done, I'm going to be like, fuck, why didn't I say him? Well, just a lot of just phenomenal smug. Doug, lately though, Doug Rappaport's.
Yeah, he's killing it. He's really young.
He's just got such a natural fucking flow, man. And his notes select. He's just so good. I actually, because he lives in McMinnville, which is outside of Portland. And I hooked him up with. That was one of my goals, was to get Paul and him together to play. And I finally did that. But Doug's, you know, he's busy with Edgar Winter Group. Winter, so, yeah. And he goes to Japan and plays with like the Japanese Elvis. I forget his fuck. I can't.
Yeah.
I tried to get him and Paul together, and Paul was like, whoa, dude. He emailed me back and was like, dude, you weren't kidding. He's serious. And I'm like, I know, bro.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, really not going to like hook you up with somebody that sucks. You're Paul Gilbert.
Yeah. Well, I had interviewed.
You are the bar in a lot of areas. Yeah, so,
Steve Morris.
He's like my main homie right now that I love playing with.
Yeah, he's a great player. All these guys, Steve Morris, Lukather, they all like acknowledge him.
So good. Yeah. So, I mean, I never got to play with either of those guys. I know it's going to come to me later. Yeah, but those are the main dudes.
Those are all great dudes, man. So, most important thing you've learned about yourself, man, throughout your life and
let me see. Most important thing I've learned about myself. Well, that I'm kind of a character. It's just become really clear probably in the last, well, you know, I had a birthday recently. And on social media, I had a lot of people post, hey, happy birthday to this guy, guys that I play with and you know, friends of mine. And they all posted at the end of their post when they were like posted, never a dull moment. And I had like three, four people post that. And I just kind of went, is that good or bad? I mean, you know what I mean? I'm like going, all right, well, I guess I'm the never a dull moment guy.
Yeah, it's okay. It's not necessarily bad.
No, not necessarily. And we were talking earlier. I've always been tenacious.
Yeah.
I've always been one of, well, what was the term that you said? Indignant?
Righteous indignation. Yeah, is a good motivator.
It's really, that term really strikes a major chord with me. I think it's one of those things. It's like, I'm going to fucking do this no matter what. And yeah. I just, you know, when you get older, you kind of realize that you just do it at the time. And then when you get older, you know, I think that's probably, you know, I'm the never a dull moment, righteous, indignant guy. Yes. I don't know. I try to be reflective and work on my character flaws, which is another AA principle.
Yeah, it's again, it's another thing. Like you should, everybody should be working on themselves all the time. It's funny, most musicians are like almost everybody I speak to is really one of their things they're concerned about is just trying to continually be a better and better person, which yeah, I think is really cool.
Shit on my side of the street.
Yeah.
Once I realize I'm dumping everywhere, I really try, you know, and I as you know, I try to use my super. Superpowers for good, not evil. Most whatever those are.
Most important thing your dad taught you.
Shit. Hey, just be a good person. Really. He's a really like he's way more calm than I am. I'm one of those dudes that if I want to, I can wake up and just be on fire and hit the ground running. Like another thing, another one of my buddies, the other guitar player, Kevin, who I fucking love dearly. And I actually try to, soak up some of his calm. He's a very calm character. Like this is the middle of the graph chart. And he's just underneath it. And I'm like, I'm way up here a lot of the time. I'm just kind of an intense character sometimes. But not in a negative way. But he's, you know, one of those dudes that like I try to like when I got sick, it was one of those things that I worked on was try to be a kinder, gentler Kelly.
Yeah,
because I can get really wound up when I see I'm one of those people that's like, I can't stand hypocrisy. Like hypocrisy drives me. I fucking redline when I see it.
Yeah.
And I just try to be calmer person and not let things wind me up, which is also like one of those things, you know. When you know, people ask me, do you have any advice for younger musicians? I'm all, yeah, be the guy that's fun to be around.
Yeah.
Be a pop because you know what? I don't care how good you are. Jaco Pastorius could not get a gig his last year of his life
right. Because
he was a mess. He was just, you know, fucking out of control. I know a lot of really talented, difficult people that can't get gigs and you know what? Be fun to be around. If you're fun to be around, people will want to be around you because you're really only on stage an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on who you play with. The rest of the time, it's hang time, man. And if you're not fun to be with, nobody's going to want to hang with you. You're not going to get the fucking call. And I think that's huge. So what was the question again?
It was the most important thing your dad taught you. We've strayed a little bit. That's all good, bro.
I had a protein bar today and it's already like 1:30. So I'm like actually eyeballing one of my protein bars. I have to put food in my car when I travel.
Dude, man, I'm the same.
Isn't my band, they see it. They're like, have you eaten yet? And I'm like, no, they're like, go eat, dude. And I'm like, okay.
Food is
my girlfriend used to put food in the trunk in the she always had like trail mix. Fucking protein bars. She's like, are you okay? You didn't eat, did you? And I'm like, no. She's like, eat something. It's in the glove box. Just eat something.
I'm the same, so I feel you.
I'm actually going to eat something right
now.
Do
it, man. Do it.
Yeah.
How about
me to just
about most important thing your mom taught you?
My mom taught me? Ah, oh, jeez. Let's see. And I lost you on here. Hang on. Where's my Skype go?
I see you, man.
There it is. Ah.
Oh, that's much better.
There you go. Sorry, I'm going to.
No, man. Pound that thing.
Kelly's getting a little. My mom taught me.
That looks good. What kind of bar is that?
Go for it. This is a. It's a base 20 gram protein bar. It's a Pro Bar.
Okay, I'm gonna check that out.
Not the Crowbar, the Pro Bar.
It just looks good.
I got it at New Seasons right around the corner.
This episode is sponsored by
you know, your neighborhood has arrived when there's a New Seasons in it.
That's right. You know, it's funny, man. My daughter has, I'm looking at, you have a tattoo right there. My daughter has a couple of those. They look like right on your finger, on your knuckle. That looks painful as hell.
That is a, that's the basses I play.
Oh, is it? Okay. I can't see. Spectre.
I know. Isn't it crazy? I got a Spectre tattoo on my finger.
Yeah, you should.
I fucking love this. Yeah. I always try to cheat on them. I'm like, because I get really bored. I'm like a shoe freak. If I showed you my closet right now, like most women are like, oh my God, I love you. Look at all your shoes.
Look at all your shoes.
I'm into shoes and boots. I always have been since I was like four.
Well, that's cool, man.
I used to put my grandfather's boots on. They came up to my crotch when I was like 3 years old. And I would walk around all across my grandfather's farm in Minnesota. And everybody would marvel at me. They're like, how does he even do that? What is going on with him? So I'm a big shoe nut. But what my mom taught me, to go for it. Because she was very shy when she was a kid. And she was very good at point when I, you know, and not to get sad again, but you know, I knew she was going to die, and we had some heavy conversations.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
She told me one of the things she said to me, she was like, you know, one of my regrets in life is I was always painfully shy and I never went for it. And I was so shy in high school and nervous. And she's like, everybody thought I was stuck up because I was so painfully shy. And she's like, you've never been like that. And she's, you know, she's like, I've always admired that about you.
Oh, that's really nice that she told you that.
Yeah. And that's just one of the things is like, you know, it just reinforced that, you know, fucking go for it.
That's awesome. It's funny. So I mentioned tattoos. I don't have any, and my older son has some. My younger son has this proposal floating. He wants us, when he was a little kid, I got this little, the FF, the Foo Fighter logo.
Yeah.
And he put it on the back of his neck. So he's proposing this thing that me and my two sons go out and I'll get this. I'm like, dude, I'm not getting, if I would get a tattoo, I don't really think I'm going to get a Foo Fighters tattoo.
Hey, you jinx the band. They'll break up. I will tell you this. Me.
Yeah.
My dad and his brother, Tom and Jerry, AKA Tom and Pepe Lemieux.
Oh, that's awesome.
They both got skunk tattoos.
That's hilarious.
When they were in the Navy. I have a skunk tattoo on the side of my head that you can't see.
Right.
Because I have hair growing over it. And my brother just recently got a really cool skunk tattoo on his arm. So
that's like the thing with the Lemieux.
That's kind of the thing. We both have little skunk tattoos.
That's all funny.
The rest of us. But yeah, not the Foo Fighters. I have no band's tattoo.
Yeah, I mean, like, why would I want I like the Foo Fighters, but I mean, like, I just wouldn't put a band's tattoo on there. I don't know.
If I ever got a band tattooed on me, it'd be AC/DC. Fuck it.
Hey, dude, last question, and I can't thank you enough for everything, especially your time. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional, and how much has that just been related to age? And I'm glad you're eating, man. I can feel the calm coming over you, to be honest with you.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah, the energy. No, but it's not, because I'm the same way. Food, I need fucking food, man.
It kind of bums me out that I'm so affected by it, because it really, like, I get like,
that's
really
pretty normal,
like,
I think, no?
Yeah, but I think I'm like really like.
Maybe you're hypoglycemic or something.
I call it psychoglycemic.
Now I get it. Okay, you said it before. The dime didn't drop. Now I get it. Psychoglycemic.
Yeah. The biggest thing that has changed in me, I think having cancer and kind of like you look over the edge into the abyss and you kind of get a little vision of what might or might not be. And I always want to be a good person. I always want to do the right thing, and the right thing's always the hardest thing. And AA, like I said before, has helped me with that. But dealing with mortality, like I had to do, I really, at the end of a day, if I'm happy with who I am, I honestly do not give a flying fuck what anybody thinks about me.
Good for you, man. If I give less fucks,
doing anything and trying to be a good person. And look, man, I'm not. It's a constant battle. I mean, that's the yin and the yang of life.
Of course,
you know, it's the old Indian proverb. There's two wolves. Which one are you going to feed? The fucking evil, angry, mean one, or the positive one?
Right.
I always try to feed the positive one. Yeah. But at the end of the day, if I know I've done the right thing and I feel like I'm being a good person and I've checked myself and cleaned up the poop on my side of the street, I don't give a fuck what anybody thinks about me.
Awesome. Gives less fucks. I think I hear you on that one, man. A lot of that
person don't care if people are like, you know, it's like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah. You don't have to account to anybody.
Yeah. As long as I'm accountable to myself and I know I've cleaned up my fucking crap on my side of the street, I don't fucking care what you think about me, because I know I'm doing the right thing and I know I'm a good person.
That's actually what I thought was pretty cool when Tommy and Mick said, because they were young at the time and they were setting boundaries to themselves, and they were taking, hey, could you please come back after we eat? That was really cool. That's what I thought, because like to set boundaries, that the way they did that was extremely appropriate. And young people, at least me, I didn't have any kind of coping skills to communicate like that at that young age. So it was actually pretty impressive.
So. I was, that was one of the things I took away from hanging out with those guys, was how gracious they were. I mean, I didn't even tell you about the fans when we were at the NAMM show. That was in 92, back when anybody could get in the NAMM show. We used to do this thing where you'd get a badge and then you would hand your badge to your bro who had a badge. Then he would take it out and give like all these other badges. Dude, I was Tom Araya from Slayer one year. Because it was the same management company as us, and they just gave me the Tom Araya badge, and I went in as Tom Araya, and there was so many people. Those guys, they couldn't stop for more than 5 minutes. There were a giant crowd would just gather around them, and they would literally have to do a runner where they're like, thanks, and they'd turn around and run, and we'd be waiting for them like 50 yards away at another play.
Yeah, that's
and
difficult.
They were so gracious to their fans, and I learned that from Tommy and from Nikki, and they were fucking super fucking gracious. And I walked away that day and I went, wow. And it, trust me, man, it's hard when you haven't eaten, you're psychoglycemic. and somebody comes up to you and says, gives you this backhanded fucking compliment. Like, oh, wow. You're like way shorter in person, which doesn't really
bother
me.
People say that? Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Who says
that? They see you on stage and they think you're like fucking 6'9".
Yeah, but who says that?
I'm fucking 5'8", barely. You know what I mean? And they still like, oh, wow. But people say like, you know, people love to be the guy. You know, I did it when I drank. I got, who's also an AA guy now, and I've seen him in meetings. Sorry, Matthew Perry, I'm calling you out. I saw him at a party, at a Hollywood party, fucked up. I was fucked up. And this is before he blew up. This is before Friends. I'm talking fucking 93, 94, whatever. And he was in a lot of these. He always played the dicky guy. Yeah. He was always the dicky dude. And I saw him and I was at the party. I'm like, oh, dude, I'm all right on him. All, you play a great asshole on TV. Now that's a douchey backhand and a compliment.
Yeah.
And it was kind of one of those things you do to kind of like go acknowledge them, but knock them down a peg, which is fucking shitty.
Yeah.
So when, you know, I try not to do that anymore. It was one of those things. I thought about it now. And I'm like, that was dude. But back to Tommy and you know, at the same time, like I said, those guys made some snarky and did that to them. They were ready to fucking drop their gloves. So
ridiculous, man. It's just amazing the things people say. I mean, it's just weird.
Pete, listen to me. People love to go, yeah, man, I took that fucking guy down a notch. They fucking love it.
Wow.
I just honestly, I try to live in gratitude and try to be a kinder, gentler self, especially after my chemo and my cancer. That was one of my things I took away from it. I'm like, Kelly, you need to be kinder and gentler. And it's a fucking battle because I am still not kinder and gentler. I feel like I suffer fools even less.
It's easy. It's easy. You know what, though, man? I went through that and I think I've done a pretty good job. And I find it's a lot less work to be nice than to be a dick, to be honest with you. It's like so much less stressful. It's awkward in the beginning because you got to be vulnerable, which is, you know, if that's an issue, and it was for me, and I still struggle with it at times, but
we all do.
You know, it's a lot easier, less stressful.
Yeah. I mean, and you think you mellow out with age, and I gotta be honest with you. I'm still a fucking pissed off 52-year-old. I still feel like I'm every bit as an angry teenager now as I was then. And I'm like, when am I going to mellow out, man?
Nah, you're not anywhere near as bad as you think. Trust me. You're totally not seeing yourself probably through the same filter everybody else is.
I just know I still feel like I wake up and I have this like, man, sometimes I wake up and I am just on fire. And that's why I went back to when I see my buddy Kevin, our guitar player in Buckcherry, the other guitar player. And those guys are great too. Stevie, all those guys. I mean, talk about having like years of sobriety and guys I can glean when I'll get like a little bit manic and crazy as we all do. And I can pull those guys aside and go, hey man, and they'll just sit down and help me out. Kevin is so calm. It's like, oh, I gotta be calm. Cause half the time I'm like going, does he hate me? I can't tell. So like, am I still obnoxious and annoying? Because I'll come out of the you know, I'll wake up in the bunk area because I go to bed late. Me and the drummer, Francis, we're kind of like the night owls in the band. And I'll get up and I've had Kevin actually turn around and look at me and go, wow, you just don't even need a grace period. You just hit the ground.
You don't need a grace period. I look at him and I go,
yeah, kind of. That's excellent. Sorry.
No grace like, period.
Can wake up and like catch a flight.
Well, dude, first of all, thank you for everything. You've given me a lot of gifts here. So thanks, man. I'm really happy that everything's working out for you health wise. And thanks for sharing your story. Oh, yeah, for sure. Thanks, Kevin. And let me tell people where to find you. I want people to check out. So it's Kelly Lemieux, a bass player par excellence, since we're talking French. Check out the new Buckcherry record called War Paint. The band is touring on it. Kelly played on it, of course. The band's touring heavily the rest of the year. They're going to be on the road, Australia, Japan, UK, South America, hopefully.
States. I'm leaving again Friday.
Where are you going to be, like, let's say June and July?
Well,
because that's where this is going to drop.
All across the U.S. And you know what? I think we go back down to Florida, too.
Well, dude.
I think there might be some Florida dates. You know what? If you go to buckcherry.com and go to the tour dates, everything's up there, man. And we just shot a new video that should be coming out here. We just shot it last week. Well, I was supposed to come home last Monday, but they're like, sorry, you're not going home.
For what song?
Video. Right Now is the song.
Awesome.
It's called Right Now.
Awesome.
And that's coming out. And just go to buckcherry.com. All the dates are on there, tour dates.
Awesome. And if you're interested in connecting with Kelly to get him to hire to do some tracks, or you want to check him out and maybe play and do some touring with him or whatever, or see if he's available, go to Instagram and hit him up. And everybody could hit him up on Instagram.
Just hit me on Messenger. Or I'm on Facebook also, but I have that also set to private. And I check my messages. But if you usually if you message me on there,
yeah, you can message people.
I try to check it. Sometimes they don't come through if you're not friends with me, but I'll try to check those if I can every night. Sometimes I don't get them, but or Instagram generally, I get a notification on that.
And on Instagram, it's Lemieux Kelly, and his last name is spelled L-E-M-I-E-U-X. Lemieux, L-E-M-I-E-U-X-K-E-L-L-Y. And if you really want to prove how devoted you are to Kelly, go up to him at a concert and show him your skunk tattoo. Is that fair?
Boom, whatever you got.
Bro, thank you so much for everything. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Craig.
Everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Kelly Lemieux for spending time with us. Please check out Buck Cherry on the road and listen to the new record, War Paint. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, you'll dig this. Happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your bass, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.